You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, in today for Leonard Lopate. Neil Barofsky arrived in Washington as an outsider, sent to investigate how the $700 billion bailout was going to be spent. Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street, is Barofsky's account of his more than 2 years spent inside TARP. It's published by Free Press, and I'm pleased that it brings Mr. Barofsky here today. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So you were brought in, as I said, as a special investigator for TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Fund program. You have a background as a prosecutor, not one in finance. So how did you come to be appointed?
So I was a federal prosecutor for 8 years here in Manhattan, the Southern District of New York. And I had done a number of things. I chased international narcotics traffickers for years, but then eventually went and did white-collar work. So I prosecuted some securities fraud cases, including against the commodities giant Refco when it collapsed. And in 2008, I was asked by the U.S. attorney to start up a mortgage fraud group because we're seeing such a spike in mortgage fraud crimes here in the district. And Mike Garcia, who is the U.S. attorney, asked me to put together a group to really try to head it off and try to lock some people up who are really committing some pretty bad crimes. After TARP was passed, included within it, I had no idea at the time, was creating a brand new law enforcement agency called the Special Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, a mouthful with one of the worst acronyms in the history of government called SIGTARP. I mean, just awful. And the White House put out a call, essentially, to different U.S. attorney's offices. Hey, do you know anyone who's got a good background in securities fraud and mortgage fraud? And ultimately, the U.S. attorney recommended me.
Huh. And so why on earth did you accept that position?
You know, I was pretty reluctant at first. When Mike was first pitching me the job, I told him that I wasn't terribly interested. I had just I had indicted a case I spent years working on. I was really looking forward to trying it in April of 2009. It was scheduled. I was getting married. We had our wedding plans in Costa Rica for January. And I told Mike I wasn't really terribly interested. You know, thank you very much. I had a little bit of experience with Washington when I was prosecuting one of the big Colombian narco terrorist organizations and was not impressed or happy with the way things worked in Washington. And Mike gave me what he called his God and country speech, is how he later described it. And he explained to me, you know, our office is just a couple blocks from Ground Zero. And the U.S. Attorney's Office had one of the first reactions to the 9/11 attacks. Our prosecutors were down there and were, from the very beginning, working on those cases. And I was very junior at the time, but I remember seeing that effort and those sacrifices. And Mike essentially told me that what we were looking at was the economic equivalent of 9/11, and that it really wasn't so much my choice to take this job, but it was my duty, my obligation to the country. I had sort of this unique set of skills that the American taxpayer had paid for over the previous 8 years. And it was a powerful speech. And I went home that night. I talked to my wife and sort of hoping she would say, no way are we moving to D.C. But she told me I had to do it. So it went from there.
Wow. After a speech like that, how can you possibly say no, even if you wanted to say no?
I even tried telling him. I said, hey, Mike, listen, by the way, I'm an Obama contributing Democrat. There's no way they're going to take me. This was, you know, President Bush. But he said, don't worry about it. They don't care about the politics.
Right. God and country. So what kinds of things were the TARP funds allocated for? And then what counted as corruption?
So TARP was supposed to, it went through many sort of different iterations. When it was first being rolled out, when it was announced by then Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, it was going to buy $700 billion essentially of mortgages and bonds that were made up of mortgages, whose depressing value contributed to the huge losses we saw in 2008 to banks and to insurance companies like AIG. And that's what it originally was supposed to do. Once the bill started going through Congress, the bill started changing, and the Treasury Secretary, the Treasury, decided to change it too. And it shifted away from that. That actually never happened. Instead, they converted into a program that primarily was going to send hundreds of billions of dollars into the banks by purchasing shares of their stock to try to fill in the holes of the losses they had suffered. And then later with time, it began a dozen different programs. It helped the auto industry. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to help struggling homeowners. All of those different things it was supposed to do. At the end of the day, it mostly helped the banks and didn't really do a lot more for a lot of other folks. But my job was to protect it from fraud.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that shift in focus was the right thing to do? I mean, I know you're not an economist, you're not in finance, but do you think that that was the right thing to do given the set of circumstances and the situation the country found itself in at the time?
I think the wheels were falling off the bus. Europe was in trouble. Europe started putting money into their banks, and they were really, the policymakers were in between a rock and a hard place, and they made the determination, and it's very hard to argue with it, even in hindsight, that they just didn't have the time to set up a big purchase of bonds, which would have been very difficult to price and do. So they went with the quickest, what they thought was the most effective thing, which is, again, just putting money into the banks. And look, I think it was most likely the right call at the time.
So when you got to Washington, didn't you have a bit of a run-in, as I call it a run-in, but I don't think Senator Shelby would call it that. You had a bit of – he dressed you down a bit. Was he trying to threaten you? Talk about that a little bit. What happened there?
Well, it wasn't so much Senator Shelby. It was I think you're referring to is how I opened the book with an incident I had with Herb Allison, who was then the Assistant Secretary for Financial Stability. You know, one of these great titles in Washington. Nobody's just called – the head of TARP. You have to be an assistant secretary of this, of that. It is a town of titles. So he was running TARP at the time, and he and I had a number of run-ins. This was in 2010. It's sort of the natural tension, I think, between my job, which was to provide oversight, and Allison's job, which was to run the program. And we came from two very different life perspectives. Allison had a career on Wall Street. He was the president of Merrill Lynch. He was the CEO of TIAA Cref. He came back and was the CEO of Fannie Mae, and was really his whole life was around Wall Street, and brought a lot of that Wall Street perspective with him to the job. Me, my perspective was I was putting those guys in jail. So I had a little bit more skeptical view of Wall Street and their motives and intentions. And we sort of, before this, we had this clearing of air. Before this, we had sort of countless arguments where I would be taking a position that we need to put in this fraud protection. We need to close loopholes for which the banks or the investment houses could take advantage of the taxpayer and cause losses. And he would push back. It wasn't just him. It was overall a lot of those Treasury people who came from Wall Street pushing back with the, oh, no, you don't need to worry about it. The banks would never do such a thing. Mm-hmm. They would never risk their reputations by taking advantage. So we had this clearing of the air. And during the conversation, he told me point blank that I was doing real harm to myself. He noted that I was just about to have a baby. Our daughter was just about to be born, and said I was young and I had a career in front of me and that this wasn't going to last forever. But that my tone was too harsh, and I was very harsh and critical of Wall Street, as well as the administration's efforts, because I thought they were falling short on helping homeowners and Main Street. And he explained to me that that could really translate into having problems out in the real world, getting a job. But he also told me that if I softened my tone, if I played ball a little bit, well, all my problems could go away. I could get a job maybe on Wall Street, or even you know, a judgeship from the White House, if I just would soften my tone. And afterwards, you made the comment of how I perceived it. I called up my deputy, and he was also, like me, a former narcotics prosecutor. And we sort of compared the incident to what Pablo Escobar used to do down in Colombia, tongue in cheek. But Pablo Escobar, of course, the Colombian narcotics lord, who would go to try to approach a judge or a politician and would offer them what they call the gold or the lead, or the bullet or the bribe, mm-hmm. which would be basically threatened to either kill them, or if they refuse to do his bidding, or a big pile of money. So we sort of compared it to that. But the problem, Jonathan, was that actually wasn't what it was. I think what it really was is an example of how Washington works. And I think in a way he was trying to be helpful in saying this is how the town runs.
I'm Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Neil Borofsky. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. So, Neil, I was going to ask you later about the differences between prosecuting narco-traffickers at Pablo Escobar and the characters you had to deal with in Washington and on Wall Street. But I'm going to ask you now, given what you just said, what Are there more similarities between the two that you found than you were comfortable acknowledging?
Well, I would say the biggest difference is when I was down in Colombia, the traffickers actually tried to have me kidnapped and murdered, and they only tried to murder my reputation in Washington when I went up after them. So it's at least it was never that dangerous. But look, I mean. In many ways, I guess the biggest parallel you can think of is that at its height, the traffickers controlled the status quo. And, the status quo was one in which they made a lot of money. It was very profitable. And it took a huge effort on behalf of the Colombian government to turn that around. And they were successful in doing so. Here, it's sort of the same thing. I think the Wall Street officials and a lot of the folks in government who really do serve their interests, particularly at the Treasury Department, as I saw, they have that same protection of a status quo that really protects the largest banks. We bailed out the banks in 2008 because they were, as we say, too big to fail. And you would think that after a financial crisis like that, whether it's through the bailout program or regulatory reform, the first order of business would be to try to prevent that from happening mm-hmm. again. Instead, what we've seen is that the too big to fail banks have actually gotten even bigger and more powerful. And what I saw over and over again, and it was really shocking to me coming from a non-Wall Street background, was just how much control the banks had over Treasury, over Washington, and how much they began to dictate the terms of their own bailout, and how much they were able to preserve and in some ways make the status quo even worse than it was before the crisis.
Well, let's pull back for a second. So your office wasn't in some, office building way off in some corner of Washington, D.C., maybe in southwest or southeast away from the action. Your office was right there inside the Treasury.
In the bowels of the Treasury.
In the bowels literally. Of the Treasury. But you were there in the Treasury building across the street, or across the plaza, if you will, from the White House. What was it like working with all of those folks?
There was a real sense of panic when I got there in 2008, when Hank Paulson swore me in in his office on my first day in December 2008. One of the first things he said to me was commenting on the status of the stock market that day. And it sort of took me aback because, watching this from afar, as most people were, and I knew things were still bad in December 2008, but you sort of had a sense that maybe we had turned the corner. And here's the Treasury Secretary basically keeping score of how his efforts by whether the stock market on any single day was moving up or down. On that same day, he told me that GM and Chrysler were about to go bankrupt and they would have to use TARP funds to save them. And, that tone, that panicky tone really continued all the way through most of 2009. Even when publicly there was a sense that things were okay and getting better, there was still a lot of fear within the Treasury Department that things were going to take a bad turn and get far worse.
Did you have a close relationship with Hank Paulson and then his successor, Tim Geithner? And did you find it necessary to have one, or better not to have a close relationship?
Well, it wasn't really my choice, but I would say I certainly did not have a close relationship. I met Secretary Paulson on that first meeting when he swore me in, and then I didn't really see him again over the course of that month before he stepped down. Secretary Geithner, I had maybe four face-to-face meetings over 2+ years. I had suggested early on that we have a regular meeting. I knew that that Secretary Paulson had regular meetings with Inspectors General, but frankly, his staff and his team wasn't that interested. When we did have interactions, it was not pleasant.
I'm talking to Neil Barofsky about the $700 billion in bailout funds that he administered and the ways he thinks the TARP funds were mishandled. His book is called Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street. It's published by Free Press, and we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and today for Leonard Lopate, continuing our discussion with Neil Barofsky about his book Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street. I apologize, Neil. That's sort of my own little verbal trip up there.
That's quite all right.
So there's so much in this book and so much from that time to get into. And I want to dive into this part where you've written that the policies of the U.S. Treasury Department are made, quote, by Wall Street for Wall Street. What did you mean by that?
So as we started digging in to the job, you know, after I got over my own initial panic, which I write about in the book, and sort of just being overwhelmed in many ways by the job that was in front of us, I originally thought of my job as being a law enforcement agency. So when they created this SIGTARP, this new agency, you know, part of its role was to be cops and robbers. You know, I built a full law enforcement agency with special agents with guns and handcuffs and bulletproof vests, and I thought the job was going to be primarily about doing that, putting people who tried to steal from TARP in jail. I kind of thought, okay, the Treasury Department's going to have this thing covered, that they understand the banks, they know the banks, and that I would just sort of be there tinkering and helping with anti-fraud provisions. What happened, though, was the job transformed almost immediately when I began to realize how little thought was going into protecting the taxpayer, how much these programs at first just seemed so biased towards Wall Street, with so little concern about what the possible effects are, what possible conflicts of interest they may be able to exploit.
And was that lack of concern due to nefariousness or just the panic that you were talking about before, that they just sort of didn't think to put those things in there?
I don't think it was either, actually. I think it really is a function in part because of the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington. So many of the people I was dealing with came from Wall Street, came from Merrill Lynch or Goldman Sachs.
The folks within Treasury who you were dealing with.
Exactly. And they brought with them that Wall Street ideology. And they truly believed what's best for Wall Street was best for America, which is why they would push back. And they almost wouldn't understand when I would point out, hey, this is really an opportunity for fraud. It was almost this puzzled look, like I was from another planet that I could think. I mean, there's some remarkable examples of that. At one point, on a $200 billion TARP program that was being run out of the New York Fed, and the president of the New York Fed, who's still the acting president now, Bill Dudley, Goldman Sachs alumni. And I was pressing him because it seemed to me that there was no protections in this program. And it was really very, very vulnerable for investment houses just to pillage the program at the taxpayer's expense. And I said to Bill, what are we going to do? How are we going to protect the taxpayer? And his response to me was, well, we're going to use the credit rating agencies. And so my response was, the credit rating agencies, aren't these the same credit rating agencies who just performed horribly during the financial crisis? And many do, in fact, credit them as being partly responsible for the crisis because they are the ones who would rate the various bonds and securities, and they just gave everything the highest rating imaginable and caused huge, huge losses. And his response to me was not to defend them because they really were indefensible, but as well, we don't think they'll embarrass themselves again. And that was what substituted for anti-fraud or taxpayer protection, the sense that these Wall Street institutions would never embarrass themselves again. And as we dug deeper and I started hearing more of these responses, I didn't find out until later when we started doing some more work that a lot of these programs were literally designed by the Wall Street institutions that that were going to benefit from them. One colleague of mine from the New York Fed eventually said to me, as we had this big conflict with Treasury, really trying to basic protection to try to avoid having certain players that Treasury was outsourcing some of the management of the programs to from just having unbelievable windfall profits. And he said to me, Neil, it's almost as if the Treasury officials' lips are moving, but it's Larry Fink, who is the CEO of one of the giant Wall Street investment houses. It's like their words are coming out of his mouth. So that's sort of how bad it became, that it was they were designing and implementing the terms of their own bailout.
So Tim Geithner, who succeeded Hank Paulson, obviously, as Treasury Secretary, he wanted to change the name of TARP to FSP, Financial Stability Program. Why was that?
This is sort of a classic Washington move. And, one of the things I try to do in the book, as the various craziness of Washington, the rebranding, the different types of deception would come up, I try to share with the reader sort of my surprise at them. But classic Washington move. If you have a very unpopular program, and TARP was a very, very unpopular program and still is today, what do? You call it something else and pretend that it's something different. So one way they're going to move it out of Treasury, but this was the FSP. And when Secretary Geithner gave this big speech in early 2009 laying out how what his mark was going to be on TARP and the different things that they were going to do, they declared it that it was from this point hence will be called the Financial Stability Plan. And for, I'd say, a month or two, every time I had a conversation with someone at Treasury, they would refer to it as FSP. And at one point, you know, we shared drafts of our reports to check facts with Treasury, and they had crossed out every time we mentioned the word TARP and put in FSP. Needless to say, we changed it back.
Right. So how much influence did Geithner have over your agency?
Well,
I mean, you were the watchdog, but...
Well, so we were supposed to be completely independent. And when Congress passed the bill that created us, they went to great pains to make it very clear that we were a purely independent agency, which basically meant that I reported to the president and that the president was the one person who could fire me. But other than that, the idea was that we were going to be independent. And ultimately, you know, the ability to fire someone is sort of the ultimate control. But beyond that, no one else was supposed to have influence. And certainly the Treasury Department, which we're supposed to be having oversight, was supposed to be – we were supposed to be independent from them. However, as we started pushing and becoming a little bit of an annoyance – in April 20, 2009, Treasury tried to bring us underneath Secretary Geithner's direction. And first they tried to postpone an interview that we were going to have with one of their lawyers about, if you remember, the huge bonuses to AIG executives right. with taxpayer funds, big controversy. So we were trying to dig into that. And they postponed that interview and then said they wanted to go to the Department of Justice and get a ruling that I would be subject to Secretary Geithner's supervision, which would have meant, among other things, he could have vetoed reports, he could have kept me from issuing a subpoena in one of my criminal investigations, could have directed me not to report something. I mean, a lot of really significant control. And I mean, it was kind of a scary move because our independence was all that we had and really all the taxpayer had. And it went along for a while. Finally, we got some help from our friends in Congress who were able to pressure Treasury to withdraw that request.
I'm sitting in for Leonard Lopate. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Sorry about that. I'm speaking with Neil Barofsky. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. So Elizabeth Warren, how did she feel about your investigation? Of course, Elizabeth Warren is the candidate for Senate up in Massachusetts against sitting Republican Senator Scott Brown.
So I met Elizabeth for the first time through this. And it was kind of funny. When I first met her, I was a little suspicious of her.
Why?
Well, you know, she was the head of a body called the Congressional Oversight Panel, which was another oversight entity.
COP.
COP. they had a much better acronym than we did. Right. SIGTARP. But there were three Democrats and two Republicans. And in the beginning, I was a little worried that it might be politicized. You know, we were taking a harsh position with both the Republicans and the Democrats. I was a little worried as a Democrat appointee, she might pull her punches. And there were some questions in the press. I was a little suspicious of her. It turns out that that was one of the dumbest things I ever did, was to have any suspicion, because she was a fierce, fierce advocate for the taxpayers. And I gained so much respect for her as I saw her consistently put her own interest below that of the job that she took. An example I talk about in the book was, you know, she was up for this new Consumer Protection Bureau,
right.
which came out of the regulatory reform effort. It was her idea. She created it. And she was under consideration for that job in 2010. And Secretary Geithner was not a huge fan of hers any more than he was a fan of mine. And there was rumors in the press that he was campaigning against her to get that job. And she had him before him for a hearing and had one of my reports and just used it to eviscerate Geithner. I mean, it was just really, really tough questioning in a way that she is remarkably gifted and talented to do. And I remember sitting there watching that just thinking, this is a rare, rare thing that you don't see in Washington. Because if she had pulled her punches, no one would have known the difference, probably would have portrayed her more as a team player. And sort of go back to what we were talking before, mm-hmm. she didn't have the right tone. And ultimately, you know, she never did get that job. So
right,
I had a great deal of respect for her. we worked together well. We did some joint projects together. We tried to coordinate with one another. At one point, this is sort of a funny story in the book, a Treasury official came up to me, sort of pigeonholed me in the halls of Treasury, and told me that, by the way, you know Elizabeth Warren, she secretly hates you. She's jealous of you. You know, she really can't stand your credibility. And, you know, it was such utter nonsense. But that's the type of dirty tricks that go on in Washington. They saw us as both a potential threat to their FSP and their narrative that TARP was working in ways for Main Street that it never did, and wanted to try to drive us apart. Right after that's when I initiated our first joint project together.
See, that story you just told, it's classic Washington. I say to folks all the time, they ask me, so what's it like living in Washington? I always ask the question, did you like high school? And most people say no. And I say, well, you won't like Washington.
That's a very good analogy. That's right. It was like it really was like a gossipy high school moment. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, you're totally right.
Mean girls and the whole thing.
They're
everywhere. So you launched an inquiry into whether the Fed had purposefully obstructed your investigation, which was ongoing when you left the Post. Do you know what the status of that is?
I don't know what the status is.
When you left, you left.
I left. In writing the book, I'd asked the agency whether it was still ongoing, and they wouldn't give me an answer. So I assume it's still ongoing.
One question that was asked that hasn't gotten an answer is from Secretary Geithner. Many people have asked him why he didn't try harder to cut the American taxpayer a better deal. And you say you've never heard him answer the question. Why do you think? Why do you think he hasn't?
Because there is no answer. Ultimately, you have Secretary Geithner, whose deference to Wall Street and putting its interest over that of Main Street, over that of the taxpayer, was so consistent in so many different aspects of TARP. There really is no good excuse. And what you're referring to specifically was in relation to part of the AIG bailout and the agreement of the New York Fed to pay AIG's big bank counterparties, the people on the other side of its bets, you know, 100 cents on the dollar for bonds at the time that were worth less than half of that amount. And there was this very half-hearted negotiation that took place, and we did a report on it. And the report upset Secretary Geithner. He took some shots at me at a press conference questioning my experience. But he never answered the question of why he didn't try harder to negotiate a better deal. You know, things like calling the CEOs together, demanding, telling them how good it was for the country, you know, things that Treasury had done in other aspects as part of the bailout, of using its sort of muscle to get things done, and it never really happened there.
So the God and Country speech that you got didn't work on the banks, it seems.
No, I mean, and that's part of the problem. You can't think of banks as human beings, as who are going to show traits like loyalty or patriotism or public service. I mean, they exist to make profit. And they've demonstrated consistently over the last few years, over the last 5-10 years, that that's all they care about, is the relentless pursuit of profit and using their size and power and status to achieve that profit. And they're not going to give something back because they're patriotic or they feel a sense of gratitude. That's why when the Treasury officials told me that they could just trust them not to embarrass themselves again or risk their reputations, I found it so shocking, because that's just not a realistic understanding of how mm-hmm. for-profit enterprises work.
Interesting. You've heard the saying, corporations are people. It's very interesting how your answer rebuts that. So we're running out of time, and there's so much in this book that I haven't gotten to, but there are a couple things I want to get to real quickly. As we already know by now, your book is very critical of Secretary Geithner. And you've mentioned also that the Treasury Department is just populated with people from Wall Street. So if the federal economic policies are so favorable to Wall Street, how do you account for Wall Street's hostility to President Obama?
This goes right back to what we were just talking about. You can't think of these corporations, or for that matter, the individuals run them, of having normal human motions, things like gratitude. They look at an election that's coming up, and they want to bet the horse that they think is going to deliver the most profits for them. And although, you know, the president famously told 13 of the top bankers at the White House, "I'm the only thing that stands between you and the pitchforks," and even though his administration, you know, led by Secretary Geithner's efforts, fought the bipartisan efforts to break up the banks when there was a real chance for that to happen in 2010. Even though they had created all of these profit opportunities within TARP, the bottom line is that there has been some good things that came out of regulatory reform, things like the Consumer Protection Bureau, things that maybe do impact the big banks' ability to be even bigger and more powerful than they were before, but still good profit opportunities that if they were removed. So they're going to back the guy that they think is promising to take all of those restrictions off and give them a path to finance, path to more money. And the second thing is, you really, much like the Washington officials I dealt with, the bankers that I've seen are just as thin-skinned and are just as offended by any suggestion that they're not superhuman patriots who only exist for good. So I think when President Obama called them fat cats once, belied by 3 years of economic policies that were for their benefit, that was all it took to send them scurrying away.
The last question I have, and later on in the show, we're going to have Dan Bartlett and James Steele talking about their book, The Betrayal of the American Dream. And so my final question to you is, do you see Wall Street as responsible for the stagnation of the middle class?
I think it's Wall Street in combination with the government. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we portray in this book is demonstrating how that happened and how much the government in the way they did the bailout helped, you know, didn't serve the American taxpayer and the homeowner. And just a real quick example, sure. You know, the Home Affordable Modification Program, the part of TARP that was supposed to directly help Main Street by keeping up to 4 million homeowners in their homes through mortgage modifications. So this is the heart of why TARP was able to get passed through Congress. And Secretary Geithner told us in 2009, when we were pressing him on the fact that the program was looking like an abysmal failure, and it turned out to be one, he defended it by saying, look, this program is going to foam the runway for the banks. And what he meant by that and what we understood that was, it wasn't about keeping homeowners in their home. It wasn't about helping people keep living the American dream. It was about making a soft landing for the banks so they could extend out the foreclosure crisis so that they could return to profitability and those record bonuses they got in 2010. And that, to me, is the heart of your question. We had a government that had a chance to choose the middle class, the chance to choose homeowners. And when confronted with that, once again, they chose the banks.
I've been speaking to Neil Barofsky, the former administrator of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and how the $700 billion in bailout funds were mishandled by the Obama administration. His book is called Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street. It's published by Free Press. Neil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.